I didn't know what else to say. I'd never seen Hank in such a state, or anybody else for that matter. There wasn't anything I could think of to say.
"You go on back home," Hank hollered. "I have ruined your life." "You ain't ruined nothing yet," I said. "This is all the flood." Tears was mixed with rain in the corners of my eyes and down my cheeks. Lightning flashed again, and I seen the water outside the door like wrinkled satin pulled away. Hank had had his moods, but he'd never done anything this crazy before.
"I'll to kill us both," Hank shouted.
"No," I screamed. "You'll feel better tomorrow. The Lord will help us if we pray," I said, my teeth chattering. I was jerking, I was so scared and cold. The horse whinnied and rammed against the side of its stall. I expected Hank to answer, but he didn't.
"The Lord loves everybody," I said. I was saying whatever come into my head. I couldn't think of what to say.
"The Lord has kicked my ass," Hank said.
"Don't talk like that," I said. I expected the lightning to hit the barn and burn us up. Instead, thunder boomed on the roof like it was a drum. The pressure hurt my ears. I put my hand on Hank's dripping pants leg.
"Come on down," I said. There was a blast of fire and a deafening roar, and I heard a crash and tinkle on the barn roof. Heavy drops sprinkled around me. It took me a second to understand that Hank had fired the shotgun straight up at the roof.
"Please, Lord, help us," I said. "Help Hank to calm down and show us what to do."
It come to me what Ma Richards would say to Hank. I heard her say it in my mind.
"You think you're so important the Lord would make a special flood just for you?" I said. "This flood is happening to everybody."
Hank didn't answer. I could smell the burned gunpowder.
"There ain't nothing special about your troubles," I said. It was hard words, but they was the truth. I was so scared there was nothing to say but the truth.
"Don't make no difference what I do," Hank said.
"You're just feeling sorry for yourself," I said.
"I should kill us both and have done with it," Hank said.
The cow bawled, and thunder slammed the roof of the barn again.
"You won't do it," I said. "You're just showing out."
It was a chance I had to take. To shame him back to his senses, I had to do something to get him calmed down. The gun fired again, and it sounded like sand was ricocheting around inside the hayloft. I hoped that was the last shell Hank had.
"Think of the baby," I said.
"I can't think of nothing," Hank said.
"Let's go back to the house," I said. "We're going to freeze to death out here."
"We'll get drowned," Hank said.
"I think the water's going down," I said. It did seem the water in the hallway of the barn was not as deep as it had been.
"Might as well get washed away," Hank said.
"Do you want the baby to die?" I said. "Do you want the baby to freeze to death?"
"This ain't no world for a baby," Hank said.
Anger boiled up in me. All the confusion and scaredness in me started turning to anger now that Hank was a little calmer.
"Get down from there and act like a man," I said, and pulled at his leg.
"Wait till the water goes down," Hank said. "Be foolish to go back now." I seen he was right. I was so cold and angry I was jerking, and I couldn't stop. I had to get out of the freezing water.
"Let's climb up in the hay and get warm," I said. My feet trembled on the rungs as I pulled myself up the ladder in the dark. Even when there was a flicker of lightning, you couldn't see much up there, except the cracks between boards. I took Hank's hand, and we felt our way to the pile of hay and crawled into it. I covered us up with straw and leaned against Hank and tried to stop shaking. The hay smelled like must and old apples. I hadn't been inside a hay pile since I was a girl. The flood roared outside, and the horse whinnied and banged at the stall below us, but I didn't hear the cow anymore. She hadn't bawled since Hank fired the shotgun the last time.
"You don't need to blame yourself," I said.
and pushed up against Hank and held his waist. Hank didn't say nothing. I guess he was wore out by all that had happened. He put his arms around me, and we laid there in the scratchy straw. I quit shaking finally, and I must have drifted off to sleep, for I thought somebody was calling to me. They was calling from a cellar or down in a holler. And then I found it was the horse neighing. I jerked up and listened. The floodwaters wasn't so loud around the barn as before. Hank had dozed off too, and I shook him. "Listen," I said. "What?" he said, and twisted himself around. "The water is quieter," I said.
"I can still hear it," Hank said.
"We've got to get back to the house and put on dry things," I said. "We're liable to catch pneumonia."
"You don't want to go back out in that," Hank said.
"We've got to," I said. We pushed the hay aside and felt our way to the ladder. I was stiff and sore, but no longer jerking as I found the rungs with the tips of my shoes and lowered myself into the water. The flood had gone down some, but was so cold it burned my ankles. I held on to Hank's leg and then his hand as he climbed down. When we got to the barn door, everything was so dark we couldn't even see the house.
"We'll have to feel our way," I said, "the way we come out here."
"I ain't no good," Hank said.
"It don't matter if you're any good or not," I said. "We've got to get back to the house."
The flood tore at my legs as I stepped into it, but I pushed my feet hard against the ground and held on to Hank's arm, both steadying him and steadying myself.
"If I fall down, just let me go," Hank said.
"If you fall down, I'll fall down too," I said, "and we'll all be drowned." But I knowed he wasn't going to fall down. Hank was strong as a big Percheron horse. He was shaky in his head, but he wasn't shaky in his big shoulders and powerful back. He was strong as a rock wall. Without a lantern, we couldn't see the crazy water, but it splashed up on my chest and took my breath away. I held on to Hank's arm like it was an oak tree. "Oh," I said, when an icy splash hit my neck. The shock of the cold water on my chest and belly made me forget myself and stop.
"Come on," Hank said, and jerked my arm.
I held on to him as the flood thrashed between my legs. Now that he was out in the wild stream, Hank come back to himself a little. Lightning flashed, and I seen the porch was not where I thought it was. We had been pushed by the current below the corner of the house, past where the washpot and clothesline was. We swung to the left in the ghostly light, and then it was dark again. By the time we got to the steps, my feet was too numb to feel anything. Hank had to help me up and across the porch.
"Let's go upstairs, where it's dry," I said.
"I'll have to find a lamp," Hank said.
When we got to the bedroom in the attic, everything looked cold and damp. The day of rain had made everything clammy, and with the fire out, the house was getting cold. I stood at the top of the stairs to let my muddy shoes and the bottom of my skirt drip as much as they would. In the bedroom, I put the lamp on the table and went back to the stairs and wrung out the hem of my filthy skirt. It was a good thing we had not moved downstairs to Mr. Pendergast's room after Lou and Garland visited us. Thank goodness most of our clothes was upstairs. "There's nothing to do but take off our wet things and get under the covers," I said. But Hank didn't answer. He had sat down on the bed and put his face in his hands, and he was crying. A chill went through me, like an icicle had been drove down my spine. I went to Hank and took him by the shoulders. He sobbed into his hands like a baby. It didn't seem possible a man as big and strong as Hank could be so unstrung as he had been that night. "Let's jump in bed and get warm," I said. I got down on my knees and untied his wet boots and pulled them off. I slipped off his soaking wet socks. "Get out of them wet overalls," I said. He let me undress him like he didn't care, like he was a sleepy baby that didn't pay no attention.
I was shivering with cold as I got his flannel nightshirt on him. I took off my own clothes and put on my flannel gown and got in bed beside him. Our feet was cold as snow. Hank had turned on his side away from me. He wasn't sobbing anymore. He was just sullen and quiet. "We'll be warm and dry up here," I said. I listened to the rain and to things rubbing and knocking on the house. I reckon boards and trees and the flood was washing against the walls. Once I felt the walls jar and wondered if the house had broke loose from its foundations. It was strange to think I was stronger than Hank. He was wore out, and I still felt like fighting. I felt of my belly where it had begun to swell a little. I cupped my hands around my belly like I was protecting it. "I'm afraid," Hank said. "I'm afraid too," I said. The fact that he was so scared made me feel less afraid. I couldn't explain it. Hank turned and put his face against my breast, and I pulled the gown to the side so the nipple was exposed. The nipple got hard and long as he put his lips to it. I run my fingers through his hair. He leaned his head over and nibbled at my other breast like he was hungry. He was so hungry he could never be filled. "You don't never need to be so afraid," I said. When I put out the lamp, it was so dark in the bedroom, you couldn't see the dark. Most times you can see the dark because there is just a little bit of light. But it was so dark, I might as well have been blind. The sight had been took away, and there was no way of seeing. The house shuddered as big trees or logs washed up against it. The house creaked and groaned as if something was pushing it. There was a kind of bark of one board slapping another. And suddenly there come a flash, and I seen the one window in the bedroom lit up with blinding chalk dust. It was lightning again. The brightness burned my eyes. Thunder hit the air like a timber slammed down on the roof. The house shook and seemed to rock on its foundation. Thunder followed thunder as though a pile of big rocks was falling on the roof. Doors was slamming all over the sky. And as soon as it quieted down, there was another flash of blue, and thunder followed like a train busting out of a tunnel. It sounded as if the sky was crumbling in big chunks and crashing down the mountainside. Thunder echoed off the ridges and repeated itself, and echoed again. And just when it felt like I couldn't stand to hear another thunder, I heard the wind. Suddenly wind brushed the house like it had been released by the thunder. Wind appeared as if it had been turned out of a cave and shoved up against the house. The eaves whined and windows shook, and trees across the valley and on the ridges above roared. I could hear another roar, too, of a waterfall further up the valley, where flood water was dropping hundreds of feet in the dark and breaking trees and churning up roots and boulders. "Sounds like the end of the world," Hank said. "Nothing is the end of the world," I said. I said it off the top of my head, but then I seen how true it was. If everything in the world come crashing down, the world would still go on. It would start all over again. The creek would go back to its banks, and broke things would rot and turn into mulch and fertilizer. The sun would dry out the mud and silt, and weeds would start growing again. Wind hit the side of the house again, and flung drops pinged on the window. "It's Christmas," I said. "Don't seem like Christmas," Hank said. When I woke up, Hank was gone from the bed. The place beside me was cold, and everything about the bedroom seemed wrong. I looked around and tried to see what it was that was so bad about the room. Everything looked ordinary, except for our wet clothes on the floor. And then I thought that it was light, which meant it was much later than I was used to getting up. I had slept too long, and I was uneasy in my stomach. Another thing that was odd was the wind had stopped. The window panes was quiet, and there was no rain on the roof. It had rained so long it sounded eerie not to hear drops on the tin roof. It was the quietness that was so strange. There was no dripping from the eaves. I listened to see if Hank was stirring around in the rooms below. The house was still. When I got dressed, my shoes were still wet, but I put on dry stockings and climbed down the stairs. Opening the door into the living room, I expected to see water standing on the floor, but there was none. Instead, there was things laying on the floor, scattered here and yon like an animal had been loose in the room. It was stuff that had been floating and was left when the water went down. Soaked cardboard boxes, pieces of wood, bottles and jars, corn cobs from the kindling box, clothespins, a broom. But the thing that struck me was not the look of the living room, it was the smell. There was the smell of a place wet and already sour. It was a stink of moldy, rotten things. The water had only stood in the house a few hours, yet the house smelled like it had been rotten for months. It was a stink of soot and charred wood in the fireplace and bitter soaked ashes. It was a stink of wet cloth and filth and festering mud. The floor was slick with a film of mud, and silt stuck to the bottom of the curtains. The Christmas tree had mud on its lower limbs. "Hank," I called. I looked in the kitchen and seen the floor was littered the same way the living room was. "Hank," I hollered. But there was nobody in the house. The kitchen smelled worse than the living room. The wood was all soaked and sticks was beginning to mold and sour. The water had brought out all the stink of the charred wood and soot inside the stove. And there was the stench of rancid grease and bits of rotted fat and crumbs from the table that had been found and loosened by the water. The floor was slick with red silt. I put a hand over my nose and hurried to the back door. I expected to see water standing in the yard, but there was only a few puddles. The yard had been tore and scrubbed by the flash flood, and most of the grass had been peeled away. Wood had floated out of the woodshed and was scattered over the yard and pasture. A chicken coop had been carried away and washed up against the pasture fence. The outhouse had been knocked over. Otherwise, the buildings was all in place, and sun sparkled on the puddles, but I didn't see but 6 or 8 chickens pecking in the mud. "Hank," I called. My voice echoed off the side of the barn. The air was so warm it felt like early fall, but the trees on the mountainside was bare. The ice was all gone and the trees flashed silver in the sun. It had indeed turned warm after the sleet. I called for Hank again, and then I seen him come out of the hallway of the barn. He was leading the horse, and he took the horse to the pasture and turned it loose. After he put up the bars of the milk gap, he started back toward the house carrying the milk bucket. I could tell something was wrong by the sag of his shoulders. "The cow is dead," he said when he got closer.
"Drowned it?" I said.
"Hung herself," Hank said. "She climbed up to the top of her stall as the water rose and caught her collar on a nail, then hung herself when the water went down." "I don't believe it," I said.
"I didn't believe it either," Hank said, "but the cow is dead, strangled by her own collar."
"We got a baby coming and there won't be no milk," I said.
"I never heard of a cow hanging herself before," Hank said.
"Can we eat the meat?" I said.
"It has already started to rot in this warm weather," Hank said, "and beef won't keep the way pork does."
"You can't salt it down?" I said.
"It has already started to rot," Hank said, "because the blood is still in the carcass."
I wondered if the meat could be boiled and canned, but I didn't say nothing. I didn't want to argue with Hank now that he was calm after the way he had acted the night before. When I went back into the kitchen, I had to adjust my eyes to the dark, but the stink hit my nose quick. It was a sweet, sickening smell, worse than mildew. It was the smell of rotten things. "First thing is to mop the floor," I said. Hank raked the wet ashes out of the stove and went to find some dry kindling in the barn. He didn't mention what he had done in the flood, and I didn't either. I got the bucket of fresh water from the back porch.
It was clean and clear and had only been touched by rainwater. I took a drink, for I was parched from the long night of worry. "The spring will have to be cleaned out before we get any more fresh water," Hank said when he come in.
"We'll have to keep fires going in the stove and in the fireplace to dry the house out," I said.
I don't think I'd ever face such a job as cleaning up Mr. Pendergast's house after the flash flood. Looking at the red mud on the floor and on the chair legs and table legs, and smelling the stench of wet wood and ashes, you just wanted to walk out of the house into the morning air and never come back. The smell threatened to make me sick. I felt like grabbing a coat and a headscarf and staying outside. The first thing that had to be cleaned was the floors, for we was tracking red silt all over the place, and it caked on the bottom of our shoes. It was like walking in red grease. The mud smeared on everything and was too deep to mop directly. Hank got a fire started in the stove, and then he went into the living room to start one in the fireplace. From the tool shed, I got a hoe and an old bucket we had used in the hog killing. I lit a lamp in the kitchen so I could see better, and with the fire roaring in the cook stove, I begun to scrape the floor like I was peeling soft paint and put the scrapings in the bucket. By the time I got to the living room, Hank had a fire roaring and prancing there. I moved the Christmas tree so I could scour under it. With the fire crackling and snapping, the house already smelled better, as if the fire was eating up the smells. When I toted the bucket of mud out to the backyard to dump it, I seen Hank was digging a hole beside the barn. It was a grave for the cow. It would take him most of the day to shovel out a hole deep enough. I wished I could do that job. It would be good to get out of the smelly house. After the floors were scraped clean as I could make them, I heated water on the stove and shaved some soap into it. With a mop, I scoured the kitchen and living room and front bedroom. I lifted all the curtains and bedclothes and hanging clothes in the closet away and tried to wash in the corners and melt the mud in cracks. Afterwards, I washed my shoes on the back porch and put on some water to boil for grits and ground some beans for coffee. Just about the time the coffee was ready and the grits was cooked, there was a knock at the front door. Who could be out visiting the morning after a flood? I was more startled and flustered than I had a right to be. I guess I was still shook up from the night before. I wished Hank was in the house and not way out behind the barn. I hoped it wasn't Timmy Gosnell drunk on Christmas morning. Drying my hands on my apron, I walked slowly to the front door. It was Preacher Gibbs and his wife from Gap Creek Church. I hadn't seen them since Mr. Pendergast's funeral. "Merry Christmas," Mrs. Gibbs said. "Merry Christmas to you," I said, and wiped the sweat off my forehead. "Won't you come in?" "We come to see about you," the preacher said. I led them into the living room, and Mrs. Gibbs handed me a little poke with a ribbon on it. Peppermint candy canes stuck out the top. "Thank you so much," I said. "Won't you sit down? I don't think any of the chair seats is wet." "Did you get flooded too?" Preacher Gibbs said. "We got at least a foot of water in the house," I said. "I've spent all morning cleaning up the mud." "The Goins' house washed away," the preacher said. "Two of their young'uns was drowned."
"And the mill got washed away," Mrs. Gibbs said. "One of the Henderson boys was in the mill laying drunk on Christmas Eve, and he got drowned."
"Now, Mother, we don't know he was drunk," Preacher Gibbs said. "Everybody knows he was drunk," Mrs. Gibbs said. "We shouldn't speak ill of the dead," Preacher Gibbs said.
"Can I take your coats?" I said.
"We can't stay but a minute," the preacher said. "We wanted to see if you and Hank was all right."
"We was lucky," I said.
"You have been blessed by the Lord," Preacher Gibbs said.
"The cow got killed," I said. "She got killed in the stall. Hank is digging a hole to bury her out by the barn."
"The Lord reminds us he's in charge from time to time," Preacher Gibbs said.
"It was a terrible flood," I said.
"We come to wish you all a Merry Christmas and invite you to church," Mrs. Gibbs said.
"Could I offer you some coffee?" I said. "I just made a fresh pot."
We can't stay, Preacher Gibbs said, but we do want to invite you and Hank to service.
We've been worried about what we was gonna do, I said, when Mr. Pendergast's heirs show up.
Nobody has heard from them, the preacher said.
They never was friendly to Mr. Pendergast, Mrs. Gibbs said, not like real children would be. Young folks starting a family need a church connection, Mrs. Gibbs said. She looked at my belly like she could tell I was expecting. I don't know how she could tell, but she seemed to know. We don't know where we'll be living, I said.
You should buy this place, Preacher Gibbs said.
I wish we could afford to, I said. When the heirs are found, maybe you can make a down payment, Mrs. Gibbs said. We don't have much money, I said. I didn't tell them about Caroline Glasscock and her husband. I didn't think it would do any good to tell them how we had been fooled. And I didn't tell about the lawyer that took the jar of money either.
The Lord will protect his own, Preacher Gibbs said, if you go to church and trust him.
It was good to hear somebody who was so confident about how the world worked. And it was a pleasure to see somebody from the community after the awful night of flood. A voice hollered outside, and I thought at first it was Hank. Sounded like he was hurt or in trouble. What was that? I said.
Pendergas, the voice yelled.
It's Timmy Gosnell, Mrs. Gibbs said. A shadow passed through my chest. There was something shameful about having a drunk man raving in front of your house, especially on Christmas Day when the preacher was visiting.
He always gets drunk on Christmas, Mrs. Gibbs said. Pendergas, the voice hollered.
His voice hurt like a saw raked across my skin. Maybe he'll go away, I said. A rock banged on the porch and rolled against the door.
Poor Timmy, Mrs. Gibbs said. When he gets like this, nobody can help him.
The Lord can help him, Preacher Gibbs said, but I doubt if anyone else can.
Something hit the porch again, and then I heard another voice. It was Hank, who must have heard Timmy hollering and come running from the barn. I opened the front door and stepped out on the porch. Timmy Gosnell stood in the yard by the boxwood, but except for his voice, I would not have recognized him. He looked like he had been made out of mud, the way a snowman is made out of snow. He looked like he had been rolled in mud and soaked in mud. Every inch of his clothes was caked with clay and silt. There was dirt and silt on his neck and face, and there was filth and river mud in his ears and pasted in his hair. His hands was crusted with mud, and his shoes was caked in layers of sand and clay. He looked like something that had been buried for weeks and rose from the dead. Only his eyes wasn't covered with filth.
What do you want? Hank said.
Hank was holding the shovel he had used to dig the grave for the cow.
You owe me money, Timmy groaned.
I don't owe you nothing, Hank said. I seen how scared Hank was by his voice. Under the dirt, Timmy could have been a rotten corpse rose from the grave.
It's Timmy Gosnell, I said. You get out of here, Hank said and raised the shovel. You owe me, the drunk man moaned.
The preacher and Mrs. Gibbs had come out on the porch, and the preacher stepped down into the flood-scoured yard.
What happened to you, Timmy? The preacher said.
Timmy turned and studied the preacher like he wasn't sure he could see him.
Rained on me, he said. You need to go home and wash up and change your clothes, the preacher said. It's Christmas.
Timmy pointed toward the house like he was having trouble saying what he wanted to.
Owe me money, he said.
Julie and Hank don't owe you money, the preacher said, and Vincent Pendergast is dead.
They took his money, Timmy hollered.
Hank stepped closer to the drunk man.
We ain't took nothing, he said.
I seen how scared and angry Hank was, and how embarrassed. I was so scared I couldn't hardly get my breath.
Now you come with us, Preacher Gibbs said to Timmy. We'll take you home.
The drunk man swung at the preacher like he was trying to drive away a yellow jacket.
I done been saved, he said. Didn't do no good.
You need to get cleaned up, the preacher said, and have something hot to eat. It's Christmas.
Won't hold water, Timmy growled at the preacher. Your preaching won't.
There's been a flood, the preacher said. Half the valley is washed away. Looks like you got caught in it.
All whores,
Timmy said, and pointed first at me and then at Mrs. Gibbs.
Now we don't need to talk that way, Preacher Gibbs said.
Hank raised the shovel, but the preacher waved him back.
Timmy, you just come along with us now, the preacher said.
He tried to take Timmy by the elbow, but the drunk man flung his hand away.
Oh, me money,
he groaned, and turned away staggering toward the road. His clothes were so heavy with mud they dragged to the ground.
What a pitiful sight, Mrs. Gibbs said.
All we can do for Timmy is pray, the preacher said.
Somebody ought to teach him a lesson, Hank said. He drove the shovel into the mud of the yard.
You can't teach a drunk man any lesson, Preacher Gibbs said.
When the preacher and Mrs. Gibbs was gone, I thought how quick the world could be turned upside down. Awful things and crazy things was there waiting for a chance to happen. I had to go into the house and stand by the fire to warm myself and calm myself. Chapter 10. The Christmas flood not only killed the cow and washed away the chicken coop, the water in the cellar made the taters rot. I saved some spuds and sweet taters that hadn't got moldy by wiping them off and laying them in the sun on the back porch. But most of the taters got soft and turned to filth that had to be shoveled into a bucket and carried to the gully. After the flood, a lot of things got carried to the gully below the spring. Rags I'd used to wipe off mud, cloth that had soured and mildewed, shoes that had got soaked and moldy. After Christmas, it seemed half the things in the house had to be thrown away. There was dried apples and dried peppers that got wet and rotted in the kitchen. And where the flood rose to the lower shelves in the smokehouse, some of the pork middles got salt soaked out of them and started to rot. By the time I'd finished cleaning the house, I felt the flood water had been poison and killed almost everything it touched, except the tools. The foundation of the house itself had been soaked and the mortar crumbled off between rocks. It looked like the floodwaters had acid in them, and everything they touched was burned and eaten away. The yard and road had been swept bare down to rock or hard red clay. The road up Gap Creek had always been rough, with long stretches of mud in wet weather and washboard ripples in dry weather. But there was now places washed out deep enough to bury a horse in. A big rock had been exposed in the roadbed, high as a wagon axle. The branch run through the road in places, and the creek cut across the roots and back above the pool place. Some ruts was washed out so deep the dirt in the middle of the road come up to the wagon tongue. If we had been broke at Christmas, we was worse off by New Year. All the meal we had was ruined, along with the taters and some of the meat. It was when Hank went out to the crib to shuck corn to take to mill that he discovered a lot of the ears had been ruined too. Mud and silt was stuck like paint to the ears in the bottom of the crib, and some of the kernels had begun to swell and sprout. Others had got moldy or was just starting to rot. It was a mess, and it was beginning to smell.
This is like the plagues of Egypt, Hank said when he showed me the rotten corn.
We'll have to dry it out, I said.
How can you dry out a crib full of corn that's soaked and molding? Hank said, like he was accusing me of making light of our problems. We'll have to shuck it, I said, and carry it into the house to dry by the fire.
There ain't room by the fire, and there ain't time, Hank said. But I figured he was arguing more with himself than with me. Since the night of the flood, he hadn't said much. I tried to forget him standing on the ladder in the barn, firing the shotgun. We'll save what we can, I said.
That won't be enough to brag about, Hank said.
I think he was mad at himself for being mad and for talking like Ma Richards. He meant to act different, but he couldn't help it. I guess nobody changes completely. It was the day before New Year when we lit in to shuck the wet corn. We piled the dry corn to the side and pulled out the mud-stained wet ears. The shucks was soggy and dripping muddy water as we stripped them off. My hands got cold quick, and I found some old gloves in the barn and kept working with the shucking stick. Some of the kernels had been stained with mud, and they would have to be washed off after they dried out. We shucked several bushels of corn and toted them into the house and spread them on quilts on the living room floor. They nearly covered the whole room. Hank built a big fire in the fireplace and made it hot with hickory wood. Soon the whole house smelled like moldy corn, a sweet, almost fermenty kind of scent. The heaped corn looked like some kind of treasure in the firelight. You could imagine the kernels was bits of gold. I warmed my hands and then went back and shucked some more. It was after we had got most of the wet corn shucked and piled by the fireplace, and I was ready to wash the mud stains off my hands for the 100th time that week, that somebody knocked on the door. It was Preacher and Mrs. Gibbs again. "Howdy," Hank said. "I'd invite you all in, but the living room is full of corn. We're drying it out." The preacher stepped inside and looked at the piles of wet, stained corn. "We was just stopping by to greet you," he said. The preacher and his wife come and stood by the fire, and I didn't know what to say. My hands was dirty and cold, and my dress covered with mud. The preacher held out his hands to the fire. "I've come by to wish you all a happy new year and to invite you again to church," he said. I'd always thought of myself as a church-going person and not somebody to be exhorted and converted. And I knowed Hank thought of himself the same way. But in Gap Creek we was new to the community and new to marriage and to each other, and we had not gone to church. It come to me that we must look like godless people to Preacher Gibbs and the folks of Gap Creek. They didn't really know us at all. "We don't know many people on Gap Creek," I said. "Then come to church and get to know your neighbors," the preacher said. "If God is everywhere, you can worship where you are," Hank said. "I can pray in the corn crib same as in the church." "But the church is where we strengthen each other and support each other. The church is the family of Christ," Preacher Gibbs said. "I would be afraid to start the new year without the Lord," Mrs. Gibbs said. I was a little offended by the way they talked, but at the same time I was flattered that they had come back up the valley on New Year's Eve just to invite us again to church. It irritated me that they looked down on us as some kind of sinners. Preachers always look down on those they are trying to convert. But I appreciated the special attention they had showed us. It had been awful lonely on Gap Creek. "We have been too busy to go anywhere," I said. The preacher looked at the corn heaped on the floor. "It won't help to heap up your treasures in this world," he said. It was a little bit like he could read my thoughts. "We're just trying to save a little corn to get us through the winter," I said. "After New Year's, it's only 2.5 months till spring," Mrs. Gibbs said. "It's the hardest 2.5 months of the year," Hank said. "We've got to get us a new cow somewhere," I said. "The Lord will provide what we need when we need it," Preacher Gibbs said. "The Lord helps them that helps theirselves," Mrs. Gibbs said. "I reckon Christians have to work as hard as anybody else," Hank said. "They have to work as hard," the preacher said, "but it means more." It struck me that he didn't say Christians enjoyed work more or had it any easier, but saying that their work meant more sounded more than just talk. It sounded like the truth, or at least the truth as he seen it. I had never met a preacher like Preacher Gibbs. He had walked all the way up Gap Creek Valley to visit us again and invite us to church on New Year's Day, and he appeared to really think about what he said. He was a man with silver in his hair and red in his cheeks. He was a farmer like everybody else on Gap Creek, and he looked like he had worked outside in a lot of wind and weather.
I felt what Preacher Gibbs had said went to the heart of things.
"We'll try to come to church tomorrow," I said.
"You will be welcome," Mrs. Gibbs said. "We'll try to come," Hank said. He gave me a look like I'd spoke too soon.
"That's all I can ask," Preacher Gibbs said.
When they was gone, Hank said, "You may have to go to church by yourself."
"Don't you want to go?" I said.
"I don't know nobody here," Hank said, "and we may be leaving here anyway."
"That's the way to get to know people," I said. But it sounded strange to hear myself talk to Hank that way, because he had always been the sociable one. He was twice as sociable as me. He loved to go to church, and he loved to sing in church. It was the fact that he had lost his job and was worried about the baby coming and the loss of his money, and embarrassed by the way he had acted in the flood, that made him standoffish. I had to help him out. The night of the flood had took away his confidence.
"We can go one time," I said, "and if people ain't friendly, we don't have to go back."
The next day was cold and clear. The ground was spewed up in places with ice, and crumbs of dirt stood on hairs of ice on the banks of the road. There is a feeling about the morning of New Year's Day. It appears like the slate has been scrubbed clean. In cities, they celebrate New Year's at 12 o'clock at night. But New Year's always seemed to me to start at sunrise, in the new light of morning. The early light on New Year's Day looks different, and the air feels different. I always imagined I can smell fresh lumber and fresh pine needles. I fixed hot coffee and grits and eggs to go with the molasses. I knowed I had to go to church. It was the first day of the new week, and the first day of the new century.
"We'll take the buggy," Hank said.
I'd been afraid I might have to walk by myself down the valley, but he must have been studying overnight about going and changed his mind. I heated some bricks in the fireplace to put on the floor of the buggy to keep our feet warm, and I wrapped myself in my overcoat and put a scarf around my head. It felt like a ceremony we was taking part in, getting ready to go to church, driving down the rough road to the forks where the church was. Hank had to drive real slow because of all the ruts and washouts. Our breath smoked in the biting air. I hadn't been to the little church house on Gap Creek since Mr. Pendergast's funeral. It was really no bigger than a chapel, made of clapboards that had been whitewashed. There was big old boys standing outside smoking their pipes, like there always is before church service. Everybody nodded or tipped their hats as we went in. It felt like everybody in the church turned to look at us as we stepped through the door. I knowed Hank wouldn't want to sit in the choir on the left with most of the older women, and I didn't figure we would set up front on the right in the Amen corner. We walked up the aisle between the benches, and Hank stopped halfway up toward the pulpit, and we sat down on the right side. I don't guess there was more than 12 benches on either side anyway. It had been so long since we had gone to a service, I felt tense, like I didn't know what to expect. I thought, how silly to be worried, for it was just a worship service on New Year's Day. But it felt like something important was about to happen. I touched my stomach and hoped I didn't get sick. A man with curly gray hair and red garters on his sleeves stood up. He held a songbook, and he turned to the woman that sat at the organ. "Number 243, let the lower lights be burning," he called out. I opened the hymnal that lay on the bench, and the organist begun to play. I was pretty sure her name was Linda Jarvis. I hadn't heard any music for months, except what I tried to sing with Hank on Christmas Eve. The organ notes filled the little church like they was coming from deep in the ground. The deep notes was like air blowing out of caves, and the higher notes was like birds singing in the sky. What a wonderful thing music is, I thought. I'd forgot how good music is in a public place. It was just a little organ, but it gathered and pushed the air in the sweetest breath. There was such color in the notes.
I seen purples and blues and greens in the air. The organ music was living breath. And when the song leader started to sing and we joined in, I seen I had forgot how voices joined together. One voice may be beautiful, and some voices not so beautiful by themselves, but when they all joined in the church, it was something different. All the voices blended and helped each other make a fuller kind of harmony. Altogether, the voices seemed to raise the air. They made the church house feel like it was lifting off the ground. I see now I had missed singing. I had missed singing with other people, and I had missed the praise of singing. Hank sung beside me. When the song was over, the preacher prayed. Lord, make us thankful for the privilege of being alive to see this new day and new year and this new century, he said. Make us grateful for the honor of being alive, for the honor of your presence and blessing. Make us thankful for your love, which is showered without condition on our unworthiness. Help us to grow in wisdom in this new year and new 100 years. Help us to see your face and your love in the faces around us and wherever we look in the world, for there is no place where your love has not already gone before us. It was the best prayer I'd ever heard. It was the kind of prayer I would have liked to make myself if I was able to. It was a prayer meant especially for me. If Preacher Gibbs had been able to read my mind and look into my heart, he could not have spoke to me any better. We will sing another hymn, Preacher Gibbs said, and the song leader stood up again. We are going down the valley, he announced.
We are going down the valley one by one, with our faces toward the setting of the sun. Down the valley where the mournful cypress grows, where the stream of death in silence onward flows. We are going down the valley, going down the valley, going toward the setting of the sun. We are going down the valley, going down the valley, going down the valley one by one.
When the song was over, Preacher Gibbs stood up behind the pulpit. It was made of ordinary planks with old varnish, small enough for him to lean over. I will read 2 short texts today, he said. One is from Matthew, and one is from Revelation. Go, therefore, and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you, and lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the world. The preacher turned the Bible to the very last pages. And the Spirit and the bride say, Come, and let him that heareth say, Come, and let him that is athirst come, and whosoever will, let him take the water of life freely. The preacher read in a slow, deliberate voice. As he read, he made every word sparkle like it was a living thing he held up to the light. I'd heard those words before, but I'd never heard such force in them. These are the things I want you to think about this New Year's Day, Preacher Gibbs said. These are the words of the great promise of Emmanuel and the Great Commission. For lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the world. And that is what I want to say to you today, that he is with us. He is with us right here on Gap Creek in the state of South Carolina. He is with us in the air of this church, and he is with us in the sunlight of New Year's Day. The Lord is with us as we go about our work. He is with us when we milk the cow or chop wood. He is with us while we sleep and when we are sick. He is with us in the still small hours, and he is with us at the hour of our death. He will hold our hand in our moment of grief, and he is present in our greatest joy. He is with the mother who nurses her child, and he is with the mother who loses her child. The Lord is in eternity, but he is with us in time also. He is present in each hour and each minute and second. The blessing of his presence is in each moment and the thought of each moment. The Lord is in the fullness of memory and the fullness of hope for the future. The Lord is in the promise of tomorrow. And in the last words of Revelation, in the last words of the Bible, in the last words the Savior spoke before the second coming, he tells us that salvation is for whoever will accept it. Salvation is not just for the chosen people, or the best people, or good people. Salvation is for the sinners, and for those afraid, and for those persecuted. Salvation is for those afflicted, and for those crippled, and those troubled in their minds. Salvation is for the liar and the adulterer, for the blasphemer. Salvation is for whoever is athirst and will take the water of life freely. What Preacher Gibbs said explained something I had always wondered about. Why would the Lord exclude so many people from heaven if he loved everybody, the way most preachers said? If only good people could get to heaven, then there wouldn't hardly be anybody there. Salvation is not something you have to search mightily for, Preacher Gibbs said. Salvation is here now for anybody who will accept it. Salvation is free as the air, and the sunlight and the water in the spring. Salvation is close as the dust under our feet and fertile as a new ground in April. Salvation is here, now. It is not some vague future. All you have to do is accept it. Preacher Gibbs was the best preacher I'd ever heard. He spoke calm, like he was thinking about everything he said. He spoke almost quiet. There was no shouting and pounding the pulpit, no ranting about hellfire like a lot of preachers did. He spoke like he was talking to you from the heart, and like he respected you. He talked like he was talking to equals, and he talked like he was speaking directly to you. He spoke like he already understood your worries. And he talked like he believed in you, and wanted to cheer you up, not make you more afraid. The way he talked, you could feel his respect for other people. He was trying his best to tell the truth and make people feel at home with themselves. Now, if anybody here would like to come forward and dedicate their life to Jesus on this New Year's Day, I will pray with them, and I will rejoice with them, Preacher Gibbs said. The only thing we have to be ashamed of is not accepting his love. We are here in the fellowship of the Spirit, and in the spirit of welcome. The song leader stood up, and the organist started playing Just As I Am. There was a hush in the church. The air was charged so tight it wanted to bust into flame. I seen it was time I rededicated myself. It was time I made a new profession of faith. Even though I had been baptized and was a member of the church on the mountain, I seen it was time I humbled myself like a little child and confessed my need for a new covenant with the Spirit. If the Spirit moves you, come forward, the preacher said. Begin a new life with a new year. We are entering a century of the telephone, of steam and speed. Are you ready to face it? I stepped out toward the aisle. I felt like I was gliding and couldn't hardly feel my feet moving. I think Hank reached out to hold me back, but then let his hand slide off my elbow. As I stepped forward, I could feel all eyes pressing on me. I was pushed by their attention. It had been a long time since I'd been looked at by so many people, but I was doing what I had to do. I walked slow to the front of the church and knelt down at the altar in front of the pulpit. "We will pray with this our sister," Preacher Gibbs said. I put my hands on the varnished wood of the altar like I was holding on to a railing. The air was warmed by the wood stove on the left, in front of the choir. The air was warm and smelled of burning oak. I've always wondered what people mean when they say they are converted or sanctified. The Pentecostals talk about the baptism of fire. Some people, like Paul in the Bible, talk of seeing a blinding light, and preachers talk about being washed in the blood.
I've heard of women that fainted, and I've heard of women that danced and shouted and spoke in tongues like Jenny Powell on Green River. But I didn't know what to expect. Something was moving me, but I could do whatever I wanted to. I was free to do what I chose, and what I wanted was to rededicate my life. "Lord, we are here to pledge our lives to you," Preacher Gibbs said. "We are imperfect and sometimes confused, but we know there is no safety and no comfort except in your will and in your love. Give us peace, and give us the patience to know peace and to accept your love." As the preacher spoke, I seen how it was such a little thing to be humble and to accept the gift of life, to face the future, to look at the future calmly. It was different from speaking in tongues, and it was different from the kind of frenzy and rapture you hear about. It was the still, small voice I wanted to hear. I didn't want to be wrenched apart by feeling. I wanted to be calm and open and wise as the light on New Year's morning. While they sung another verse of the hymn in quieter voices behind me, I prayed myself. "Lord," I said, "make me worthy to have a baby and raise it. Life with Hank is going to be hard, as everybody's life is hard. Give me the strength to face the pain and to eat the pain like bread. And give me the sense to know joy and to accept joy. For I know I'm weak and can't sustain myself alone. Teach me to accept what is given to me." When the singing stopped, Preacher Gibbs reached down and took me by the hand and helped me stand. "Sister Julie," he said, "do you accept Jesus as your personal Savior?" "I do," I said. It sounded like a marriage ceremony. "Do you dedicate your life to His will and glory and His work?" the preacher said. "I do." "Do you wish to join the fellowship of this congregation?" "I do," I said. I hadn't thought about joining the church. I'd only thought about rededicating my life to the Lord, but I seen it was the thing to do. Since I was living on Gap Creek, I should belong to the Gap Creek Church. Our fellowship could only be with those around us. What I felt as I looked out into the faces of the congregation was not any sweeping whirlwind or flash of light. The joy I felt was steady as music you hear behind you, sustaining and clear. The faces looking at me was not of saints, but ordinary people. And that was the congregation I wanted to be part of, just ordinary people like myself. I didn't need to be part of any special group. I was just a sinner that had accepted grace, and I needed the fellowship of other sinners. "Shall we open the doors of the church?" the preacher called out. There was nods, and several of the deacons said yes. "All opposed?" the preacher shouted. Nobody spoke up. "Do you come to us on profession of faith?" Preacher Gibbs said. "I do," I said. "Let's all come forward and give Sister Julie the right hand of fellowship," Preacher Gibbs said. I stood there beside the preacher while the organist played "By Jordan's Stormy Banks." And one by one the people in the room come forward. The women in the choir come first, and some shook hands with both hands and looked me in the eye, and some only shook with one hand and didn't look me in the eye. Some of the older women hugged me, and some of the younger women had tears in their eyes. I looked into their faces as each one come up. I didn't usually look people I didn't know right in the face, but I wanted to stand closer to them and be close to them. I wanted to be near people. There was young boys that come up, so young you wouldn't hardly think they was members of the church, and they wouldn't look at me. They shook hands with faces turned aside and hurried on. And some big old boys that had outgrowed their clothes, saw the pants come up to their ankles, grinned and looked like they would like to kiss me if they dared. And older men wearing overalls and flannel shirts and blushing because they was not used to shaking hands with a young woman, come forward and took my hand for a second. The only grown person left standing in the church that didn't come forward was Hank. He stood by himself and looked down at the bench in front of him. The last people to come forward was the elders, the deacons on the right side of the church. Some of them was very old and stumbled up to the front of the church with their canes. Some had long white beards stained around the mouth with tobacco juice, and some had not shaved in a week and looked grizzled. Some was clean-shaved and their faces was weathered like shoe leather. Some of the old men's eyes sparkled like they was young boys looking out of their wrinkles at a pretty girl. And some had cloudy eyes like they didn't see too well and wasn't even trying to see. As I shook all the hands, I had a sweet, calm feeling. In front of everybody, I didn't feel exposed. I felt the warmth of their attention and acceptance of me. The church was a warm and welcoming place. In the cold January day, the warmest place was in the fellowship of the congregation. It was the place of music, the music of fellowship and communion. After I went back to my place beside Hank, he didn't look at me. He looked straight ahead like he didn't even know I was there. But I wasn't sure why. After all, he was a member of the church at Painter Mountain, and he had been baptized, and he liked to sing hymns and lead in prayer. He looked off into the dark corner of the church like he didn't hardly care, or was still thinking of the night of the flood. After I joined the church, I felt better about living on Gap Creek. We didn't have no money, and we didn't have a cow, and Hank didn't have a job. But there was a fellowship at Preacher Gibbs's church that made you feel connected. In the worst times there is, you can get through with the support of other people. In fact, you can only get through with the help of other people. When I lived at home, I had always been helped out by Mama and my sisters. I'd never really been left to the mercy of myself before. Every time I went to church after New Year's, to a prayer meeting or a preaching service, or to a singing, I felt better. And when one of the women from the church, Mrs. Gibbs or Elizabeth Rankin or Joanne Johnson, come to visit and sat with me in the kitchen or by the fireplace talking, I felt like a human being again. A woman has to have a woman friend to talk to. "I didn't think you wanted to join the church down here," Hank said. "Does that mean you think we're going to stay here?" "They are mighty friendly people here," I said. "If they are so friendly, why ain't they helped us find Mr. Pendergast's heirs?" he said. Sometimes Hank acted like he didn't care what happened, but his worry always circled back to the house and finding out who owned it. We couldn't afford to move nowhere unless he got a new job, and we could only stay in the house until the real owner showed up. The uncertainty of it wore Hank down, that and the worry about the baby coming. It was like a man to show his worry, but never talk much about what was making him angry. But 4 weeks after I did, Hank joined the Gap Creek Baptist Church, too. I knowed he would change his mind because he loved going to church and singing just as much as I did, and I knowed he would change his mind without telling me, that he would not admit that he was wrong, but would go ahead and join. I had learned Hank's ways, and I thought that was what he was going to do, and it was. It was late January, and we was attending Sunday service, though the road was froze, and there was ice in puddles and along the edges of the creek. The air in the church was toasted by the little stove in front of the choir, and the church was filled with the smell of hot metal and burning oak and the lift of the preacher's voice. When Preacher Gibbs called out the invitational hymn and gave the altar call, Hank stepped out in the aisle and went to the front of the church. He'd done it like he had planned for days to do it. He had made up his mind without telling me. That was his way. Hank didn't kneel down at the altar like he was praying. He stepped in front of the preacher and said something to him. And I seen him reach out his hand like he was going to shake hands, like he had said he wanted to join the church by profession of faith. And then I seen him fall forward like he was going to lean on the preacher's shoulder, but he sunk out of sight. I must have hollered, for I heard somebody cry out as I run down the aisle to see where Hank had fell to the floor. I'd heard a knock like a rock hitting a block of wood, which must have been Hank's head hitting the floor. He sprawled in front of the altar, just like he had fainted. I bent over him, and the preacher rolled him over.
Hank, the preacher said.
Hank's face was white as a pocket handkerchief, and his eyes was rolled back. I wondered if he had died or had some kind of fit.
You folks stand back, the preacher said.
The singing had stopped, and people was gathered around to look at Hank.
Bring him some water, Preacher Gibbs said.
Somebody brought a dipper of water from the bucket at the back of the church. The preacher lifted up Hank's head, and I held the dipper to his lips.
Wake up, Hank, I said.
I tipped the dipper against his lips, and water spilled down on his chin. Hank opened his eyes, and some color come back into his cheeks. There was a startle in his eyes when he seen all the people gathered round and looking down at him.
Stand back, the preacher said and waved his left arm.
What? Hank said.
You must have fainted, I said. Have a drink of water.
Don't want a drink, Hank said. He put his hands back against the floor to push himself up. The preacher and me helped him to his feet. There was a red mark on his forehead that was beginning to swell to a pump knot. Hank took a deep breath like he was trying to catch his wind after a struggle. He grinned and looked embarrassed. Everybody was gathered round, and there was no way he could escape their attention.
Brother Hank is asked to join our church by profession of faith, Preacher Gibbs called out. How do you vote on his membership?
Yay, several voices called.
All opposed, the preacher said.
Nobody said nay, and the preacher declared the yeas carried the motion.
Let's all come up and give Brother Hank the right hand of fellowship, he said.
He motioned to Linda Jarvis at the organ, and she begun playing, Bringing in the Sheaves. People formed themselves into a line and come forward to shake hands with Hank. He grinned, 'cause he didn't know what else to do after fainting in front of the whole church. But I think he was relieved, too, for he wanted to sing with the congregation and pray with the congregation as much as I did. For Hank liked to lead in prayer, and he knowed as well as I did it was better to sing with others than to stand off silent by yourself.
Chapter 11. It was a good thing Hank and me joined the church and had the support of the church, for things got harder that winter. Along in early February, it come the hardest freeze I'd ever seen or heard of. It reminded me of Cold Friday. The sun come out on Gap Creek, but it didn't do much good. The sun was little and cold in the sky as the tip of an icicle. The ground was set like steel. It got so cold frost started growing like white ferns and fancy lace on the window panes, and fire in the fireplace couldn't heat the house enough to make it melt. It got so cold, the mud puddles and low spots in the road set hard.
Can't stay this cold for long, Hank said when he come in with his face and hands red.
What if it snows? I said.
Too cold to snow, Hank said.
How can it get too cold to snow? I said.
It can't snow when it gets near zero, Hank said.
Almost all our taters had been ruined, and some of the canned stuff. The flood had rotted all the meat on the lower shelves of the smokehouse, and we had ate up most of the rest of the meat by the beginning of February. The cow was gone, and there was no milk or butter. It was too cold for Hank to want to climb up the ridge looking for turkeys.
Everything is hiding away in thickets, Hank said.
We had some cornmeal and grits and a little bit of shoulder meat left, but we was fast running out of coffee and sugar and things that had to be bought. We didn't have but a few cents of money. By early February, my belly was beginning to show. Everybody could see I was expecting.
You should eat more than you do, Hank said.
I eat plenty, I said.
You ought to eat more to grow a strong baby, Hank said.
The thing I was beginning to crave in the cold weather was jelly. Hot biscuits and cold jelly. I'd ate all the jelly Mama had sent with Lou and Garland.
There were still a few jars of blackberry jelly and grape jelly and apple jelly in the basement, but only a few. I brought them up one at a time and wiped off the dust and ate jelly 3 times a day. I had to stop myself from eating jelly between meals. I put jelly on cornbread and I put it on oatmeal. I wanted jelly so bad I could have eaten it with a spoon. I thought constantly about the cool, quivering softness of jelly melting on my tongue. There is something about the firmness of jelly that makes it taste better. Jelly has body and has to be cut. It won't pour like honey or molasses. Jelly is soft rubies or amber. Jelly is almost alive. I crave jelly so bad I put it on grits and mush when I run out of biscuit flour. I wanted jelly so much I smeared it on whatever else I was eating. I dreamed about jelly, and I imagined I was eating it with butter and toast, long after we didn't have any butter. I dreamed I was eating jelly and drinking milk, and that was the perfect thing for the baby. I dreamed about jelly and feared we would run out of jelly before the baby was born. I counted the jars. There was only 4 left. On the 4th day of the cold spell, when the sky was clear as a big bubble the sun played its light on, there was a knock at the door. I wondered who could be out in such withering cold. I prayed it wasn't Timmy Gosnell. It was Elizabeth Rankin and Joanne Johnson. They had scarves wrapped around their heads and around their faces. Their noses was red as coals. "Come on in before you freeze," I said. Even after I closed the door, I could feel the cold air falling off their coats. I led them to the fireplace. "We want to see how you was doing," Elizabeth said, and looked at my belly. "Takes all my strength just to stay warm," I said. They unbuttoned their coats but didn't take them off. I asked them to please sit down. "We can't stay but a minute," Joanne said. "I'm mighty glad you come," I said. Elizabeth opened her coat and took out a bag she had been carrying beneath it. "Here's a few things I thought you could use for the baby," she said. She opened the bag and took out a little flannel jacket that looked small enough for a doll. "Most of these things is for a bigger baby," Elizabeth said, "but you'll need a few things for when it is first born. And because it's yellow, you can use it for either a boy or a girl," Joanne said. I took the little jacket, and it looked no bigger than a glove. The flannel was soft as velvet. Elizabeth reached into the poke and pulled out a little gown and another jacket. She took out a coat and cap. "My Jessie wore these a few years ago, but they're practically new," she said. "I certainly do thank you," I said. I felt my eyes get moist. I'd never had many women friends, and I was touched that they had walked in the cold to give me the baby clothes. They made the cold February sweeter and the heat from the fire sweeter. Joanne reached into the pocket of her coat and pulled out something wrapped in tissue paper. "I have brung you this," she said. It was a pair of knitted booties and a cap to match. They was made of lavender and blue yarn in a pattern that reminded me of a picture I'd seen of stained glass windows. The yarn was so bright it seemed to glow. "I figured these colors will suit either a boy or a girl," Joanne said. Her fingers looked too rough and swelled at the joints to do any knitting. I leaned down and hugged her. I was so touched. "You have both saved me a lot of work," I said. "When a baby comes, a woman don't have time to make clothes," Elizabeth said. I sat down and held the baby clothes on my